or fish. Caddo Lake is on a major migratory bird flyway, and tens of millions of flying creatures, ducks, geese, smaller birds, pass through each year. The songbirds may be the most remarkable, Rick Michaels said. This is the only place I know of where you look around and see a red bird and a blue bird and an orange and blue bird all at the same time. We have eagles and alligators. We were motoring in the midday sunlight, so we didn't see the other wildlife that Michael said abounds in the region and comes out at night or in the half-lit crepuscular hours. Wildcats, possums, snakes. The waters support more than 70 species of fish, including recently a prehistoric-looking creature called the paddlefish with a long sawtooth snout. The paddlefish is the oldest surviving fish species in North America. It once abounded in these waters, and in a partnership between the Caddo Lake Institute and the Fish and Wildlife Service, has been reintroduced. Caddo is almost as significant for what it is not, the Texas author Joe Nick Petoskey wrote in the Texas Observer in 2005. No condos, no high-rises, no chain motels or restaurants, no resorts, no gated planned communities, no margarita bars, no chains, no pretension, none of the trappings of modern Texas lake culture. Caddo Lake may be in northeast Texas and relatively close to urban centers in all directions, but for those who get Caddo, it is a natural jewel, just as worthy of protection. There is no place I care about more, Don Henley said when I talked with him soon before our visit. We spent a full day at the lake and another exploring Marshall, famous in the 1950s as the home of the New York Giants quarterback Y.A. Tittle, and in the 1960s and 1970s as the home of the LBJ aide-turned-journalist Bill Moyers, and viable now in part because quirks of the federal judiciary have made the courts of the Eastern District of Texas, headquartered there, a favored venue for those filing patent claim lawsuits. We saw enough to get an idea of the difference that committed local patriots, Henley, Shulman, Michaels, their allies, could make in the fate of a region. By quirk of timing, we apparently missed the next big challenge to Caddo's environmental and economic viability. The wind had been strong before our visit, and the winter had been cold, so the dark waters were mainly clear of the peril that threatened the lake, a plant called giant salvinia. One by one, salvinia plants are tiny rather than giant. Their leaves look like miniature lily pads, and they are related to the familiar and harmless Salvinia auriculata, a common household aquarium plant. But the similar-looking, ominously named Salvinia molesta is the horror movie version. It originated in Brazil and has spread so rapidly worldwide that it is classified as a major invasive plant species. The problem with the bad Salvinia is how rapidly it grows. I suspect that every high school math student has dealt with a trick question involving spreading lily pads. Question: if lily pads double in size each day and cover an entire pond in 30 days, when do they cover half the pond? Answer: on the 29th day. Salvinia molesta is that math question brought to life. It's capable of doubling its coverage not every day, but every 5 to 7 days. This means that a tiny colony can cover an entire lake the size of Caddo within weeks. And when Salvinia weeds cover the surface, they cut off the sunlight, meaning that aquatic life below them dies. Other plants, fish, the ecosystem as a whole. The plants pile up. The lake dies and reeks. What had been an environmental success story becomes a failure. In 2017, Lauren Beale of Texas Monthly quoted a Caddo resident, Robert Spite, on what Salvinia has meant for Caddo. 10 minutes from leaving the dock, you can be in an area that looks just so totally primitive you wouldn't know what century you were in, let alone what day of the week it was. All I can think about now when I go out is what Salvinia is doing to the lake. The inner peace is gone. This is the threat Caddo has faced with increasing frequency over the past decade. During our visit, wind and cold weather had kept the lake mainly clear of giant Salvinia. But a year later, it was back and spreading too quickly for mechanical harvesters to hope to keep up with. What is the main source of hope? It, too, is coming from the Caddo Lake Institute. Researchers at Texas A&M and elsewhere have found that a particular species of weevil eats Salvinia molesta and apparently nothing else. If released into a Salvinia-infested body of water, these appropriately named Salvinia weevils will eat away at the invasive plant, but then not, it seems, mutate, develop new appetites, or start eating other forms of vegetation that humans value more. After our pontoon boat ride across the lake, Rick Michael showed us the greenhouses where the Caddo Lake Institute is rearing weevils on industrial scale and looking for new varieties that will survive local winters, which cruelly can be just cold enough to kill most of the insects without impeding the Salvinia at all. Doesn't this sound like the beginning of some sci-fi novel? I asked him. Breeding voracious weevils? What could go wrong? Yeah, I know, he said, but it's the best answer we have for now. Texas A&M, which had been leading the weevil research, had budgetary cutbacks, so Caddo Lake Institute offered more funding to fill the gap. Researchers there are working now with the fish and wildlife officials to build weevil greenhouses around the lake and to transport the weevils carefully to the lake once they're mature enough to survive. They can't really cover any land distance on their own, so you have to walk them the few feet to the lake, Michael said, and maybe that would keep them from going someplace we didn't intend. Caddo Lake needs everybody's love, Rick Michael said as we drove back to Marshall. It takes attention and affection, and that is what will save Caddo.
In the air. I knew as we headed north that the language we'd be hearing would change again. The slow southern drawl of Mississippi would tighten up and become more nasal as we turned toward Ohio and on up to Minnesota. I was eager to listen for more versions of something that first struck me in Greenville and has become what I've come to think of as the question. The question. Put yourself in a social situation with people you don't really know but are trying to get to know a little more or maybe just have a conversation with. This is the question that comes after some version of how do you do or nice to meet you or how are you. We can call it the conversation opener, or more specifically, the second question. I realized we were onto something in Greenville, South Carolina. Two women, both transplants to Greenville, reported to us in surprised tones that the question people asked them after the first question was, "Where do you go to church?" They were flummoxed. We were flummoxed. Does that sound a little presumptuous or personal or prying or audacious or even offensive? Or is it exactly what those of you from Greenville would expect to hear? Well, besides a general consensus in my unscientific polling that this is the question in Greenville, I also heard from people from smaller towns in Idaho, Virginia, Maine, Kentucky, and all over the South who confirmed that this is how they get their conversations rolling too. In Chicago, older people told me that the variant, "What's your parish?" was so ubiquitous in their parlance growing up that even the folks who weren't Catholic knew exactly which parish they lived in. Some said the same for Boston. Then there is St. Louis. I challenge each of you to ask someone from St. Louis about their question. Without fail, and I've tried it with hundreds of people, the answer is, "Where'd you go to high school?" If you draw towns into a Venn diagram of this question, the entirety of St. Louis fits inside that circle. I'm told the school question is also popular in Cincinnati and Charlotte, Louisville, New Orleans, Baltimore, and the island of Oahu. What we are really intending with a question like, "Where do you go to church?" or "Where did you go to high school?" is to find a rather gentle, regionally and socially acceptable way of sizing someone up. We're using the question to gather valuable information about their socioeconomic, cultural, and historical background. The question is a veiled probe of, where do you fit into my world? Or, let me understand who you are. One person wrote me that the answer to what's your parish is used as a social marker for everything from your baseball team to your likely politics to your geographical desirability as a candidate for a movie on a Friday night. A woman from Texas said the answers carry a political overtone in her hometown of Waco, since everyone knows which churches are left or right-leaning. A second culturally loaded question, asked in many sprawling metropolitan areas like D.C. or New York, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Houston, is, where do you live? The more granular the answer, the better, say the folks from the big cities. Boston becomes Cambridge or Somerville, and then shrinks farther to the nearest square or subway station, Davis, Porter, Harvard, Central, Kendall, etc. Chicago becomes Northside or Southside, then a smaller slice like Near Northside or South Loop. In our hometown of Washington, D.C., the generic answer of D.C. is usually followed by some divvying up into the quadrant or sections of the district versus the suburbs of Virginia or Maryland. One person from New York suggested that the question may just be an excuse to lead into everyone's favorite subject, real estate. Someone from the Low Country of South Carolina in the southeast part of the state said the calibration becomes which bend, as in which bend of the river. I've been asked the default question in Washington, D.C. countless, truly countless times. What do you do or where do you work? The question reflects the currency of the town. The answer, according to many who offered their interpretation, suggests a measure of a person's power and connections. I would add politics, passion, and money to that mix as well. It's a New York question, too, and probably common in other cities with a predominant industry like tech in the Bay Area or academia in Boston, or what they call the industry in Los Angeles. Some younger people told me that they shy away from that question because it reeks as too sensitive or judgmental among a generation of those who are having trouble landing jobs, or don't have a direction, or are just taking their sweet time figuring it out. Where are you from is a popular opener in Seattle, Austin, Madison, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and the entire state of Florida. It makes sense since so many people have moved there from elsewhere, maybe for a tech-rich environment or a guaranteed liberal culture, to stretch for the golden ring, or simply for the weather and absence of taxes. Two places avoid this question, Alaska and Hawaii. Why? The Big Island of Hawaii is a relocation spot for the Federal Witness Protection Program. Alaska is well known as a place where people can start troubled lives over. Where are you from can be an unwelcome foray into dangerous or uncomfortable territory. What are you? This blunt question is after a description of ethnic or racial heritage. In Philadelphia or Boston or more rural towns with big European populations, the question assumes that someone will say Irish, Polish, Italian, or German, or maybe Hispanic or Native American. A lot of folks told me that they cringe when people ask this question. At first, I thought it was a joke when I heard, "Who's your mama?" Until someone explained that in New Orleans, where everyone seems to know everyone else, they know who your daddy is from your last name, but your mama, now that's another matter. So the question really means, who are your people, or who do you belong to? Folks from New Orleans also told me that a variant of who's your mama is, how's your mama and them? That's probably more for people you already know, and it strikes me as being soaked in Southern personality. Finally, there's a grab bag of geographically specific openers, many of which reflect a strong local culture or preoccupation. In fun-loving meccas of the country, like Burlington, the question, what do you do, actually means, what do you do for fun? Answers often circle around winter sports. In Denver, the question may be, where do you ski, bike, hike? In Los Angeles, it's about cars and driving. How did you get here? The answer usually takes the form of, I took the 10 to the 405. And there may be a follow-up. What do you drive? In San Francisco, what will we be eating? Or what smells great? Or what did you bring? In Chicago, in response to who do you like, there are only two possible answers, the Cubs or the Sox. In Birmingham, the question is, Alabama or Auburn? In Laramie, did you get your moose yet? I'm not kidding you. In orange-growing redlands, do you have a citrus tree? There is an expectation, nearly an entitlement, that every backyard will have a citrus tree. Once, when I replied that our little rental house didn't have one, a kind of pained look fell across the face of my questioner, and he asked again, just to be sure, "Really? Are you sure there's not even a small orange tree?" Later that week, I found a few bags of oranges, grapefruits, and kumquats on our front step. A lot of people told me that they dislike every one of these possibilities. As a questioner, they feel intrusive. As a respondent, they feel boxed in and often judged. A few people suggested that they are more comfortable asking an open-ended question, one that invites a person to take any number of directions to answer. It's a question something like, "So, what's your story?"
Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, Ohio was by far the biggest city we visited. It has well over 1 million people in the metro area, more than twice as many as the state's second biggest conurbation in Cleveland. The city itself is the 15th largest by population in the country, just behind San Francisco, but ahead of Seattle, Boston, and Denver. Because of a dense concentration of Columbus-based retail and apparel brands, the Columbus area is a national leader in the size and value of its fashion design industry. Ubiquitous national brands like Wendy's and semi-ubiquitous ones like Bob Evans Restaurants and White Castle Burger Shops are based there as well. But in terms of media presence and the pop culture industry, Columbus looms nowhere near as large. It's still an out-there-in-the-real-America city, as opposed to one of the focused-upon and minutely chronicled coastal centers. Everyone can imagine a street scene from Boston or a vista of Denver from the movies or TV. Very few people outside Ohio have any mental picture of Ohio State Capitol or the city's now-thriving German Village and Short North or Arena districts, or the Franklinton area, which is in the middle of redevelopment. A Columbus resident named Alex Fisher told us early in our visit, when you ask people where they're from, they can just say Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Nashville without adding the state name, even though there may be a lot of Nashvilles in the United States. But you always hear Columbus, Ohio, for a city this big. Fisher was making a point about the civic dream of allowing "I'm from Columbus" to stand on its own as a statement. It seems an impossible dream, given the number of already known other Columbuses on the map, including, for us, the Columbus that is the heart of the Golden Triangle in Mississippi. We heard this theme a lot, and it is a clue to what we came to understand about the civic and cultural benefits that come from Columbus's mixed big and little status. Like Sioux Falls or Greenville, Columbus seems to think of itself as a much smaller community than it actually is. You can imagine problems that might come from this mismatch of reality and perception. For instance, a city thinking it can address all its challenges in a person-to-person way without realizing that it has outgrown that approach. Columbus is a major metropolis, with all the scale and resources that go with that status. In cultural and operating patterns, it remains more intimately connected, and thus able to respond more quickly and with more practical mindedness to challenges as they emerge, rather than being tied up in procedure or partisan standoffs. What does this mean in practice? Following are two perspectives, starting with Alex Fisher's. "When I first saw the downtown of Columbus, it looked like nothing," Alex Fisher told us in his office downtown. Fisher, a sandy-haired, athletic-looking man in his late 40s, had first visited the city in the late 1990s and early 2000s, when he was putting together a research partnership with the Patel Memorial Institute, which is headquartered in Columbus and, with an endowment from a local engineer and philanthropist named Gordon Battelle that has grown to some $6 billion, is one of the nation's largest, if least publicized, research centers. Of course, I'd heard about Columbus for fourth-grade memorization of the state capitals, Fisher said, but this was my first look at it, and I thought, wow. He didn't mean this in a positive way. At that time, the prospects for downtown Columbus seemed bleak. Department stores closing. Small retail spaces vacant or occupied by pawn shops. Life and business migrating to the suburbs. Downtown streets deserted and often dangerous after dark. An old, decaying state penitentiary sat in the middle of town. Fisher and his family moved to Columbus nonetheless. The opportunities for him at Battelle and for his wife in the state government were too attractive to pass up. But I often think about how different that first impression would be for someone seeing the city afresh right now, Fisher told me. The site of the former state pen has become the city's showcase downtown redevelopment project, with an arena for the Columbus Blue Jackets hockey team and $1 billion worth of surrounding investment. As it happened, seeing the city afresh was my own angle of vision on this visit, since Columbus was the most sizable U.S. city I had never previously set foot in. And what I saw, viewing it afresh, was a humming, stylish downtown, very much like what we had seen in Greenville and Burlington. Retail stores with lots of daytime business, and restaurants and bars and theaters and brewpubs that were busy at night. Parks that were busy, with office workers on lunch breaks and some families. Old retail and warehouse buildings that had been converted into residential lofts and condominiums. All the elements of what we were beginning to think of as the normal, healthy downtown package. Fisher proposed to explain the town's metamorphosis to us from his perspective as CEO of the Columbus Partnership, an organization that connects business, civic, charitable, and educational institutions in the city. Up through about age 40, I feel as if I've been able to live the experience of this new cosmopolitan South that was coming into being, he said. Fisher had grown up in a small suburb of Nashville, done his undergraduate and master's degrees at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, then worked on the Tennessee governor's staff in Nashville and at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Nashville, Charlotte, Atlanta, they didn't really exist then in the form they do today. It was a lesson to me of how much can happen in a short time period. I mean, 40 years, it's half a lifetime, it's a blink. Fisher said that he was aware only in retrospect of how profound a transformation of the urban South he had been living through. From his childhood in the 1960s and 1970s until now, the South, as he put it, went through a really major social and economic transition. There's still a long way to go on the social side, but it's profoundly different from the time when I was born. When he got to Columbus, he thought it was time for a comparable transformation of cities in the Rust Belt. The Midwest doesn't need to go through quite the same social transformation as the South, he said, referring not just to the legalized structures of segregation, but also to other aspects of openness and tolerance. But, he said, the cities and their infrastructure were built for an era and an economy that no longer exist. The era of huge factories with thousands of workers streaming in and out at the end of each shift. Northern cities had to rearrange themselves for an economy of smaller, faster-changing, higher-value manufacturing sites, more offices and co-working spaces, less automobile-centric development, and more walkable streets, and all the other traits of a 21st-century urban layout rather than a 19th-century arrangement. Fisher led us through the nuts and bolts of how Columbus was diversifying its economy. It had the steady base of state government and the university. Its away from the coast location gave it advantages as a transport and distribution hub. Battelle, which had become an engineering and technology research center employing more than 20,000 people, and would be more famous if it were in Seattle or Palo Alto or Cambridge, produced a steady stream of spin-off tech companies, as did Ohio State itself. In addition to its retail and fashion chains, and the national restaurant companies that are based there, Columbus is a major financial center. The largest private employer in the area is J.P. Morgan Chase, with a staff of some 16,000, followed by Nationwide Insurance, with some 11,000, and a very large hospital and medical care sector. Fisher pointed to dots on the map to illustrate the highlights. Over here, an enormous historic downtown department store building that had been shuttered in 2003 and reopened 6 years later as a modern office and retail space after a public-private renovation effort. Over there, a new park on the site of a former 1970s-era eyesore parking garage. Next to the park, downtown condos and apartments, practically unknown when Fisher got his first view of the town. Even 10 years ago, all of this was just wasteland, he said, gesturing through the window to what were now city blocks bustling with activity. And I realized that now, if the university or a high-tech firm is recruiting someone good from San Francisco, the feet-on-the-street impression of the downtown is going to be very different from when I first came here. The recruiting point was more than rhetorical because of Columbus's ambition to attract people who might otherwise assume that they are headed for the biggest cities on the coast. Our branding is about being open and smart, he said. We want to be a community that celebrates a diversity of lifestyles in a community that is young and vibrant with lots of different perspectives and origins. Fisher was well aware that every smart city wanted something similar. But he argued that Columbus's scale and culture gave it an edge. I've spent a ton of time in Knoxville, which I love, but they just don't have our scale, he said. I've never lived in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. Obviously, they have the scale of economic activity, but that very scale overwhelms the right social connections we're able to maintain. That's the secret sauce for us. I'm not sure there are a lot of places big enough to do anything, but small enough actually to get it done. What was most interesting was Fisher's description of how and why Columbus had been able to rebuild its downtown and broaden its economy. He emphasized themes that, as he admitted even as he was talking about them, could sound like platitudes and cliches. Spirit of collaboration, spirit of openness, long-term commitment to the community. But by this point in our travels, I was recognizing the similarities to what we'd heard about successes in places from Michigan to Mississippi to South Dakota. Fisher underlined that point. If I had to give you one punchline for what's happened here, it would be the collaborative spirit of a group of business leaders who felt something was expected of them, the kind of local patriotism and civic engagement we'd first heard about in Holland, and got organized to say, how can we make this a better place? I know the term public-private partnership is overused, but that's really what you saw here.
We traced the city's web of collaborations, crisscrossing among business, government, philanthropy, startups, educational and civic institutions, the arts, and public-private partnerships. There is so much collaborating going on in Columbus that the edgiest among the collaborators have coined a new, shorter, more imperative word for this. Collab. I first heard collab when I was walking along High Street in the short North District of Columbus. The street is famously loaded with restaurants, shops, art galleries, and boutiques. I stopped in as many as I could. Near the top of the street was a place named Co-op. Co plus op. I'm not sure how to describe it. An art gallery? A fashion-forward clothing boutique? A vintage clothier? A consignment shop? Yes, I think it was all of these. There was art on the walls, some old luggage and paraphernalia, a rack of newly designed clothes, some old, also known as vintage, clothes. Food trucks sometimes park in the lot out front. Everything was for sale at what struck me as high prices. The manager back then, Kate Cutler, a millennial with bright red lips and dressed in fashion to match the shop, described the atmosphere of Columbus that draws many of her generation back. After 6 years of corporate life in Chicago, she said she wanted to find a way to engage her creative side. Of co-op, she noted, we collab a lot with Mouton, which is the wine bar and restaurant across the street. They held events together. Such edginess moves Columbus forward, but it doesn't always last, as I discovered when I heard the news 2 years later that Co-op had shuttered. I recalled our years in Shanghai, where you'd have to be street savvy when dropping off dry cleaning or shoes for repair, as there was a real chance the shop would disappear to new construction if you waited too long to retrieve your belongings. Mouton, at last report, is still going strong. One of the food trucks that travels around and sometimes parks in places like the High Street lot was Ajumama, which means ma'am in Korean. I met owner Laura Lee when she was parked in a lot next to the indoor-outdoor Seventh Sun Brewing Facility in the Italian Village section of Columbus. It was an early Friday afternoon, perfect for a late lunch with a little local beer. Lee cooked up one of the family recipes she'd adapted from her Korean mom's collection. Pajeon, a green onion pancake, followed by hodok, a sweet pancake with brown sugar, cinnamon, and walnuts. Lee says she's a stickler for ingredients, making her own kimchi and personal pancake mixes from scratch. They've earned her a bunch of awards and trophies, which sit on a shelf next to the order window. Lee is a Columbus returnee from San Diego, where she worked as a sous chef until deciding that Californians didn't appreciate her experimental creations. Several things have been working for Lee in Columbus, including a vibrant startup food truck culture and encouraging efforts from the city. The city recently eased up on licensing and parking rules and regulations for food trucks. Then they created a city government position pluckily named Small Business Concierge to cut through the red tape and provide advice for getting small ventures like Laura Lee's up and running quickly and successfully. Another self-made Columbus transplant is Thomas McClure. We met for a glass of wine in the historic German Village neighborhood, walking distance south of the city center. He grew up in cattle country about 2 hours west of Dallas with his Thai mom and American dad. To talk with Thomas McClure is to be swept up into his force field. He is all energy, speed, and can-do attitude. From an early age, McClure wanted to be in entertainment. A model and actor, he became a business partner in the talent agency that represented him. He started a runway show as a fundraiser for local designers in Columbus in 2010. It quadrupled to 1,200 attendees in 4 years. McClure says that cooperation and support happen naturally in the fashion industry in Columbus. Big brands, the likes of Abercrombie & Fitch, Designer Shoe Warehouse, Victoria's Secret, Lane Bryant and others get along with the little startups and boutiques, he explained, and operate as though there is room for all to work for the greater good of fashion in Columbus. Several times we heard the mantra that Columbus is number three in fashion design after New York and Los Angeles. A more elaborate collaboration in Columbus takes place at the intersection of education, public institutions, and business. One afternoon, I was leaving the elegant Columbus Public Library. The library's CEO, Patrick Lazinski, had just told me about the Cristo Rey Columbus High School, when, as if on cue, the school's development director, James Ragland, rounded the corner. The library can be a meeting place of sorts, intentionally or serendipitously. Our near collision was the latter. Ragland was at the library to figure out some of the ways the school and the library might work with each other. He offered to take me on a tour of the school, which was right next door to the library, the next day. The Cristo Rey Columbus High School is part of what is now a 28-school network that was founded in Chicago by Jesuit priest John P. Foley in 1995. The schools are strategically located in cities with a needy urban population, a supportive local Catholic diocese, and cooperative, deep-pocketed businesses. Columbus, as an energetic, creative, and generous city, fit the bill perfectly. I went to visit Cristo Rey in its new home, formerly the Ohio School for the Deaf, which it purchased from the Columbus Metropolitan Library. The school's president, James Foley, no relation to the Jesuit founder of Cristo Rey, John P. Foley, told me that Patrick Lisinski had told him that Cristo Rey didn't need its own library, since its students and teachers could use the public library right next door, and thereby have the best high school library in the country at their fingertips. The building still had some of that new car smell. The old wooden floors had been polished to a radiance. The paint was fresh. The big windows were sparkling. The rows of student lockers were unscratched. The massive $20 million renovation was still underway, focusing then on the upper floor science labs and art studios. The majority of its funding had come from a creative combination of state and federal tax credits for historic building preservation and new job creation. Most of the rest came as a loan from the local Catholic diocese. The mission of the schools, as Ragland describes it, is to break the cycle of poverty through education. The average annual family income of Cristo Rey students network-wide is about $35,000. Founder John P. Foley says of Cristo Rey schools, "If you can afford to come here, then you can't come." The Cristo Rey students are needy. According to the school, some 83% of them were eligible for free or reduced lunch. Some 60% of the 188 students were African American, 25% Latino, and the rest a variety. They were of all faiths. Ragland and the school's principal, Kathy Thomas, strip away the sterility that comes with reporting statistics like these by telling their students' stories. Of the ninth graders, three had parents who had died, two of them from violence. Lucky students come from two-parent households. Others have parents who are incarcerated. Some live with grandparents, others in foster homes. Still others drift in and out of homelessness. Some are in non-English-speaking households. "We reflect America," says James Ragland. Cristo Rey found a creative way to fund most of the tuition, $18,000 per student to start, and projected to drop several thousand dollars per year as enrollment climbed. In Columbus, $5,000 per student per year is potentially available from Ohio's School Choice Voucher Program. If a student's home school is designated as a failing school, that money can follow the student to a school of choice. When I visited, 59% of Cristo Rey Columbus students were eligible for vouchers. The second piece of the business model is the Hallmark Cristo Rey Corporate Work Study Program. Each student works 5 days per month on a regular business day, not a Saturday, at a paid position in one of Columbus's many dozens of partner companies or institutions. The students' earnings, about $6,500 per year, are applied directly toward their tuition. Unmet differences come from donations, fundraising, grants, and families, even if the latter is just a token amount. The work-study program sets high expectations. Employers know that Cristo Rey will make site visits and will require daily timesheets, evaluations, and action where the kids need more help, training, or mentoring. Sometimes companies go well beyond this, bringing a student into staff meetings or arranging a meal with the executives. Some kids translate their school year work into summer jobs. Others become more realistic about the opportunities in their futures. When I asked one boy what his dream job would be, he immediately said, "Professional football player." I've heard this answer from countless high school boys around the country, by the way. "And," I asked, "if that might not work out?" "I'd like to own my own business," he said, "or maybe be a civil engineer." Many of Cristo Rey's Columbus employer partners do much more for the school's community. Nationwide Children's Hospital provides the students with preventative medical services at the school every Friday. The PNC Bank offers a financial literacy course for the students and their families. Other programs were in process. The library is partnering with the school to create ESL and literacy programs for the families. Nearby Franklin University and the school are talking about continuing education programs for the students' parents. Ragland describes the importance of the school's pervasive culture of positivity. "The majority of their day is with us. The message is delivered in context from the janitor on down to the president." That phrase shows how seriously he takes the concept. The role and place of the teachers is paramount. They are handpicked for both their teaching and their strong match of character to the beliefs and culture of the school. Principal Kathy Thomas says of the instructors that their behavior is witness for the kids. The school offers generous packages to its teachers, including small classes, good pay, professional development, and retraining. In year two, Cristo Rey Columbus High School was a work in progress. The entire school staff, the students, the families, the town businesses, the institutions, are all invested in collab to make it work. To me, an early sign of success came while I was chatting with three of the second-year students. One began to get fidgety and started sliding down in his seat. The student next to him began subtly nudging him and giving him the look, which clearly meant, sit up straight, look her in the eye.
A public-private partnership obviously entails a public element as well. Columbus is a strong mayor town, both structurally and in the personality of the man who held the office in recent years. Michael Coleman, a prominent local lawyer and city council member, became Columbus's first Democratic mayor in 30 years and its first African-American mayor when he took office in 2000. He was 44 when first elected and was easily returned for a total of 4 four-year terms, getting nearly 70% of the vote in his last two races. By the time we met him, he had become the longest-serving mayor in Columbus's history and the longest-serving black mayor of any U.S. city ever. Though still popular, he had 4,000 guests at his 60th birthday party in 2014, he decided not to seek a fifth term, and he stayed in town to go back into law practice and marry the woman who had been his unofficial companion through his final two terms as mayor. When we met him in the mayor's office in Columbus, in the stately white limestone neoclassical-style city hall built in the 1870s, Coleman was halfway through what would be his final term. A smooth-mannered man with modish big-framed glasses and a thin mustache, he leaned forward with a smile as he described the close calls he had had in office and the clever approaches he had figured out. Part of the story Coleman had to tell was about the transformation of the city during his years there. "Our downtown used to make you yawn after 5 or 6 at night," he said. "Nobody was there. And of course, now it's been turned around. A dynamic place. Thousands of people living down here. All these new parks and businesses. During the weekdays, it's probably an 18-hour downtown. From Thursday to Sunday, it's 24 hours. And as I'm sure you've heard, it was the result of a public-private collaboration." We had indeed heard that and could see the results for ourselves. But the particular story Coleman wanted to describe was what happened soon after he began his third term in office, when the local, national, and international economies were all thrown into reverse by the financial crisis of 2008. When I think about what our city has achieved, I point to one seminal moment, he said. It was a moment that made more difference than anything else, maybe in 100 years. And it was a tax increase. A tax increase during the toughest economic times since the Depression. That's when we made the choice to become the Columbus of the future. When the citizens, together, voted to increase their taxes and invest in the long run. At the national level, pushing taxes up when the economy is going down is, of course, a recipe for Herbert Hoover-style self-intensifying depression. Many cities and states are obliged by their constitutions to balance the budget every year, and so they have no alternative. At just the moment when their citizens have less money of their own, fewer customers at restaurants and stores, shorter hours at the office or factory, worse prospects of selling a house, more pressure from banks to repay loans, either the city must ask for more from them in taxes, or it must cut back the services it offers for schools, police and fire protection, road maintenance and other upkeep, and all the other ingredients of a healthy civic life. Historically, the city of Columbus has had a strong economy, Coleman said. We had multiple legs to our economy. The center of government, the financial institutions, the schools, diversified business. we were a center of jobs for the entire state. So if you cut off one leg of the stool, the others were there, and it would still stand up. But in the fall of 2008, he said, all the legs of the stool were cut, every last one. We could have had 15 legs of the stool, but whoosh, they were all cut, all at once. As he was obliged to under the city's charter, by November 15th, Coleman had come up with a balanced budget proposal for the city council, paring expenses to make up for the expected shortfall of revenues. But barely had he submitted it when the collapse intensified. Within 30 days, we had to reduce our revenue estimates by another $100 million, beyond the shrinkage we already foresaw, Coleman said. The overnight change represented nearly a quarter of the city's total planned revenues. My initial inclination was to try to weather it, he said. That is, to keep making cuts in pace with the falling revenue. I'd been mayor a long time. I knew we'd weather the recession after the 9/11 attacks, and we had come back. But as the weeks went on, and the collapse continued, and the revenues continued to fall, and the proposed cutbacks intensified, Coleman said he resolved to try a different approach. I had a lot of sleepless nights because I thought the city really was at a crossroads, he said. One path would be we could just continue to cut the hell out of our services and expenses. We could lay off a few hundred policemen and a few hundred firemen, which is what I was preparing to do, on top of big layoffs already, and cutbacks everywhere else. But if we did that, I thought it would change the city for a generation. Everything we'd worked for would be at risk. We could go that route, but we'd have a city that is more like Detroit. Coleman hastened to add, no offense to Detroit, but he was using its declining years as a shorthand for a downward spiral of worse services and a more dangerous environment, which in turn drove businesses and more affluent residents away, which in turn drove revenues and services down further still. You've seen these Midwestern cities that just die, he said. So I thought we had a choice. And the other choice was a tax increase. In specific, he proposed raising the city's income tax rate from 2% to 2.5%, a change projected to offset the latest $100 million shortfall in revenues. By state law, such a change required a majority vote approval by the city's electorate. So as bankruptcies and layoffs were increasing, family budgets were tightening, and the city's unemployment rate was nearing its highest level in a generation, Coleman joined with members of the business community to argue in public that paying more for city government was the right next step. The business community joined with the campaign. Why? I asked Alex Fisher of the Columbus Partnership. I think it was a question of trust, he said. The mayor had a track record. The city finances were well run. We could all see that solving the problem by cutting was going to lead to a very different city. When the vote came in August 2009, turnout was relatively low, but 52% of those voting approved the tax increase, enough to put it into effect. The lead of the next day's story in the Columbus Dispatch spelled out the choice the city had made. Police and fire recruits might begin training in December, after freezes on recruitment and training. Recreation centers are likely to reopen in January. Your grass clippings will be hauled away free next spring. And if you earn your paycheck in Columbus, you'll begin paying higher taxes starting October 1st. About the political nightmare of selling a tax increase, Michael Coleman noted, when you start these things, you know you're going to have 75% of the people against you. And all the more at a time when people are losing their jobs, scrambling to buy a loaf of bread. But we knew the city had two paths. One that has an upward incline but leads to the point of success versus the path that sends us down into the valley. We chose to climb the mountain and we got it done. It was the beginning of the new city you see around you now. But how could this possibly have happened? What made the politics of Ohio's biggest city so different from those of the nation as a whole? Coleman said that the key was the ability of cities, his and many others, to insulate themselves from the paralysis of national-level politics. "I've often been asked if I want to run for governor or senator," he told us. Before he became mayor, Coleman was a Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor of Ohio in 1998, losing, with his running mate Lee Fisher, to a ticket headed by Bob Taft. "There was a time when I was asked if I was interested in the presidency," he recalled. But this is where the action is. This meant city government and being mayor in a strong mayor system within a functioning civic culture. "There are a lot of broken pieces in government," he said, "but at this level, you can be more effective because you have to be. I'm a Democrat, but I've worked very successfully with Republicans in the business community, and now with our Republican governor," he noted, referring to John Kasich. "I'd like to have the Congress see what they can learn from us."
Some of the assets of Columbus that Alex Fisher and Mayor Coleman talk about, deep public-private collaboration, size, the accessibility of its people, are vital to one of the town's stellar institutions, the public library. Patrick Lisinski, who leads the Metropolitan Library System, described Columbus as being large enough to have international companies and small enough that he can call up a CEO and say, "I'd like to talk to you about some things around the library." The community of Columbus has stepped up repeatedly for the public library. In 2010, facing a loss to the library budget from state revenues, voters passed by more than a 2-to-1 margin an increased tax levy for $50 million per year for better library services. This followed the previous year's city tax increase of 0.5%. In 2013, the Metropolitan Library Foundation raised more than $500,000 at a gala fundraiser. The library's board of trustees brings affiliations to powerful institutions like hospitals, investment companies, insurance companies, and The Ohio State University. Others, like the Friends of the Library, contribute in many different ways. The library's legacy and its story go way back. In Columbus, word got around in the early 20th century that Andrew Carnegie was funding the building of libraries. Columbus City librarian John Pugh hopped on a train to New York and knocked on Carnegie's door. Pugh and Carnegie bonded over their Celtic heritage. Pugh's was Welsh, Carnegie's was Scottish. And Carnegie eventually gave Pugh a handsome $200,000 to construct the beautiful granite and marble Romanesque building. "That is about the cost for a thorough cleaning of the library today," Patrick Lisinski told me. With the recent renovation of its original design, the main library is iconic all over again. It overlooks Topiary Park, a 7-acre park and garden that feature trees shaped to resemble figures from Seurat's famous post-impressionist painting, Sunday Afternoon on the Isle of La Grande Jatte. I strolled the tree walk through the park looking for buckeyes, which I remembered as the state tree from my 7th grade Ohio history class. I found them, but disappointingly, they were the least healthy-looking among the whole collection. Someone offered, rather spookily, I thought, that perhaps it was because the trees were growing on the spot of a suspicious fire that burned down the abandoned buildings of the Ohio School for the Deaf in the 1980s. Lisinski left no doubt that the most important message to take away from the Columbus Library was that on the stone engraving above the grand entry: "Open to all." Those words were there to remind every single person who enters of this nearly sacred message of public libraries in America. By 9:10 in the morning, some of Columbus's homeless were already inside the library. I saw homeless people spending their days at most public libraries I visited around the country. They would be sitting, sleeping, reading, or sometimes eating in the library cafes. In Columbus, there are understood expectations for appropriate behavior: no sleeping, no bathing, and in the case of strong odor, counseling on where to get a shower. There are warnings and penalties for inappropriate behavior, which include a day's or a week's sabbatical from the library. On the other end of the economic spectrum of customers is the term of art favored by the Columbus Library instead of the more common term patrons. As I traveled around the country, I became accustomed to spotting young entrepreneurs who set up virtual offices at long reading room desks. They would take phone meetings outside in the gardens, often with lattes from the library coffee shop in hand. "Do you resent this?" I asked librarians around the country. "Not at all," the librarians invariably answered, adding that one day when their companies were flush, these titans might remember where it all started. After visits to dozens of public libraries from Maine to Arizona, from Mississippi to Minnesota, I saw that America's public libraries, the place people used to go primarily to find books or do research, have become the heart and soul of American communities. I learned that in the library I could discover the spirit of a town, get a feel for the people's needs and wants, and gauge their energy and their mettle. By my calculation, I would say there are three areas where libraries today reflect and serve the people: technology, education, and community. Here are the stories about the first two. Technology. Enter a library and the first thing you're likely to see are banks of computers. The computers are so popular that in many libraries there are waiting lists and restrictions on time use. The Pew Research Center reports that today, about a quarter of American adults lack broadband internet connection at home. Many library computer users are among them. Disclosure: I worked at Pew for several years in the early 2000s. From Appalachia to the Bronx, I heard library directors' stories about discovering laptop users huddling near the library after hours to catch the strongest internet signal. "Behind the dumpster," exclaimed Alan Engelbert, the library director from Charleston, West Virginia, when he learned that was where one man sought the best Wi-Fi signal in the wee hours of the morning. "Holy moly," said Anthony Marks, the director of the entire New York public library system, relating to an elite gathering in Aspen what he'd blurted out when he'd seen a New York teenager sitting on the steps outside the library after hours, capturing Wi-Fi to do his homework. Librarians all over the country know that this happens, and many leave their Wi-Fi on all night for just that reason. Jim and I applied the same trick when we first visited Ajo, Arizona. We squatted at night in front of the library storefront in the town's historic plaza, the only reliable place in town to check email or read the online news. Some libraries lend out Wi-Fi hotspot devices so people can carry connectivity home with them. In Erie, Pennsylvania, Aaron Winsek, who has since become the library's director, told me that the library's 10 newly purchased Wi-Fi hotspot devices were spoken for immediately, creating an instant waiting list. The librarians ordered 15 more. In Columbus, I heard this true story about one of the most popular uses of the library's computers, the job search. A young man came into the library looking for help locating a job opening and filling out an application. He and the librarian spotted a good possibility, and the librarian helped him load the application onto the screen. They agreed that he would fill it out, and then she'd come back around again to look it over. A little while later, the librarian returned to discover that the man had completed the application, not by keying in the responses, but with a marking pen on the screen. That is low-end technology use at the library. At the high end are the makerspaces. A makerspace is a communal 21st-century workshop where hobbyists, artists, entrepreneurs, artisans, designers, and dreamers share hardware and software, like 3D printers, laser cutters, wire benders, and hammers, to create and build. Around the country, we've been to makerspaces that are franchised like gyms, where you can take out a membership. We've seen others in forward-looking companies where employees are encouraged to spend their time with the most sophisticated tools, bringing ideas to reality. And there are makerspaces in libraries. They are free and open to all. In my hometown library, the flagship Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Library in downtown D.C., I joined a standing-room-only crowd to tour the makerspace named the Fab Lab, with some 30 other people, from budding entrepreneurs to a mom with her homeschooled preteens. Everything about the makerspace felt collaborative, accessible, and cool, including Adam Schaefer, the young library associate in shirt sleeves and a wool cap, who introduced us to the 8 3D printers, one of which was named Kevin Spacey. We saw the laser scanner and the laser cutter, which can etch metals, cut cardboard, wood, and paper, and even etch pumpkins, one of which Adam passed around. There was a wire bender named Fender Bender Rodriguez. There was a milling machine that can make prototypes out of wood or plastic or even soft aluminum. More humbly, there was a tool station resembling a basement workshop along one wall, with lots of super glue, duct tape, inspirational how-to books and magazines, and a collection of old-fashioned tools.